Hey Alexa, what's the definition of hustle?
To be aggressive, especially in business or other financial dealings.
You're listening to the H for Hustle podcast, designed to inspire future entrepreneurs to take the leap from working for someone else to pursue their passions and side hustles and turning them into full-fledged businesses. My name is Jerome Fenton. I'm a serial entrepreneur. Every week, I'll be speaking with an entrepreneur that has taken that leap. We'll be talking about the lessons they've learned and how they've turned their passions and side hustles into full-fledged businesses. H for Hustle Podcast, welcome back. Another illustrious episode up ahead. And on today's episode, guys, it's a rewind episode. One of my favorites, episode 68, Richard Matthews. Richard's story is pretty interesting because Richard and his family live in an RV and they travel around the United States. And he's building his business and he built his business while being in this RV. So I really like this episode because it's how someone is living an alternative life and still building a business. I'm not going to waste too much time. Let's get into it right now. Boom. For Hustle Podcast, welcome back. We have another great guest. So today's episode, we have Richard Matthews. Welcome to the show, Richard. How are you doing today?
Awesome. Thanks for having me. It's glad to be here.
So, Richard, if we were to meet on a Zoom dinner these days, right? what would you say you do for a living?
I would tell you that I run a full service podcasting agency.
Okay.
And that I do that while traveling the country full time with my wife and four kids.
Wow. Okay. So, how did you get into running a podcast agency? How did that start?
It's kind of an interesting story, right? So I run my own podcast called The Hero Show. And The Hero Show is part of my other brand. And we help entrepreneurs who are in the educational coaching space those areas. We teach them how to build a heroic brand, which is everything from like building your website to getting your photography done to figuring out how to write and outline and teach your courses to getting your webinars, sales stuff, like all the funnels and everything that need to go into having an educational online business. And we've done that to the tune of selling several million dollars with our clients over the last several years. And the last step of that process, right? I have a whole process I have called the Digital Alchemy Formula. And the last step of that process is called your content machine. That's the why in alchemy. And your content machine is all about, if you're going to build and create sales and create leads and attention and awareness and authority online, you have to get your message in front of an audience, right? And there's two ways you can get your message in front of an audience. Way number one is you can buy their attention, right, with ads. And you know, there's lots of different ways you can do ads, everything from direct mail to Facebook to YouTube, whatever. There's the ad side of that. And then the other side of that is you can build an audience. You can buy an audience, you can build it. You can also borrow an audience, which is sort of a halfway between that. That's what I'm doing here as I'm getting on your podcast and borrowing your audience for an hour. Yeah. And so when you do the build on the audience, that's when you're going to do something like build a YouTube show or build a podcast or build a Facebook Live following, something like that. And I had a whole list of things like, hey, here's how you do it. And here's like the step-by-step on what you should do on a weekly basis and when you should show up and how you should do it and what you should do with the content afterwards and how you should break it up and how you should advertise it and everything. So it would all go into feeding their sales funnels, right? And actually creating more business awareness and attention and leads for their business. And I would give that to my clients and then only like 25% of them would do anything with it. Right. And the ones that did, all of them are millionaires now.
Wow.
Right. Right. So over the course of time, I was like, you realize there's a lot of power into building your own platform, right? Building your own audience when you go to that. Like I had one of my clients, he built his YouTube show up to, I think it was like 20,000 viewers. And then one afternoon he was like, I have an idea for a product. Because my clients or my audience has been asking for this. And so we went down and we spent an afternoon and we outlined the product and we put the product all together. And the next day we offered it to his YouTube channel and he made $24,000 in sales, 48 hours from an idea. Right.
Wow.
And the reason that happens is because he's spent the time to build an audience.
And he's engaged with them.
Yeah, he's engaged with them. And so when it came time, like when I started to put my own podcast together, right, The Hero Show, which was, again, it's all part of that heroic brand business, is I got the first 8 episodes recorded, right? And then I started following my own steps, which, you know, most of the time I'd have my clients follow the steps and do them. And it's like, there's what you find out is that podcasting right? And when, especially if you're talking about multimedia podcasts like this, where you have video and audio and you're going to turn it into additional content, there is a lot of work that goes into what happens after you hit that stop record button. And I'm sure you're familiar, right? If you record an hour's worth of content, you have just created for yourself a good 10 to 15 hours worth of work at a minimum.
And then that's if you're good at editing audio. If that means if you're good at editing video, that means if you're a decent writer, you can turn it into a blog post. If you don't, then you're going to be stuck with just...
It's a lot of work. Yeah. And if you just create it and you don't do all of the additional work, it's not actually giving you the benefit to your business.
Yeah.
So I managed to get 3 episodes done all the way to getting it out, getting them promoted, getting the content turned into it, all the way done. Got 3 episodes out. And I was like, holy crap, that's a lot of work. And I'm not going to be able to continue doing that while also continuing to serve my clients. So I actually had to put my show on the back burner for, I think it was like 2 years. I had recorded 8 episodes, but only got 3 of them out. I was at a mastermind at one point, and one of my mentors basically pulled me aside and said, "Hey, the thing that's holding you back in your business is you. You're your own bottleneck."
Got it. Like, so you're trying to do everything.
Yeah, he's like, "You need to take these systems that you're building for yourself and bring in people that can help you build them." So I did that. And over the next year, the first system that I built was like, hey, where's a big place that I know I can get a win if I wasn't doing all the work, was building my podcast, right? Building all the work for the podcast. So we actually set out to build push button podcasts just for my show, right? So I actually built out all of the processes, built out all the training, built out all the cool stuff we do. We have some really, really nifty stuff we do with Trello and Zapier and whatnot, where we can actually take a podcast that takes, it would take someone else 10 to 15 to 20 hours to get all the work done. We can do it in 4 or 5, right? And get it all the way done and completed because of how succinct and cool our systems are. And I hired the staff and trained them, did all of that stuff. And then the very next year, we go back to that mastermind group. And I had 80 episodes recorded and published and all over the place for our podcast. And I had this whole system built out, and I showed my mastermind group. I was like, hey, this is one of the things I worked on my business this year. And it was really cool. And they all were like sitting there dumbfounded, being like, can we buy that from you?
Like,
and
I was like, the service.
And I was like, well, I hadn't planned on it being that way, but I don't see why not. Like, I built it all to be scalable. And so I started taking on clients, and that mastermind, the name Push Button Podcast was born. And literally now I've got 155 episodes recorded on our podcast, and I haven't done a damn thing for it other than show up and hit the stop record button and the stop record button. And my staff handles everything else, everything from booking our guests to booking me on other podcasts to handling everything else. And then all of the clients that we've brought on, they do the same thing, right? They show up, they push the stop button, they push the stop record button. So they literally push button, everything else happens. We do everything for them. And that's how that business sort of was built and where it is now. And we're at the price at this point now with the growth of that, where I'm like, we want to scale that. We want to go to, I think we've got like 4 or 5 shows we're managing now. We want to take that to 10, 15, 20 shows. And maybe in the next couple of years, have 100 shows that we're managing.
Yeah.
So that's where we're at now, and we're looking to grow.
And podcasting, in the sense, the space itself is so fresh and it's so new, because I was reading an article that we just passed like the 1 million mark for podcasts that have been started. So you could just only imagine how much more podcasts we have. There's about, 500 million blogs in the world, and they're still generating revenue. So I can only imagine where the podcast space is going to be. So you're getting in very early on the ground floor of what's to be something really, really big.
Yeah, hopefully. And hopefully it'll have a big impact, because the idea is that, like, when you have a podcast and you have a show, right? And like, podcast, the term has sort of expanded over the years. Like, if you go back 4 or 5 years ago, it was literally just an audio show that you could just find on Apple's iTunes system. Yeah. And now a podcast is anything that, like, they call YouTube shows podcasts, and they call Facebook shows podcasts. And sometimes they'll call it a podcast, and they'll be on all those channels. It'll be on Facebook, and it'll be on Periscope, and it'll be on YouTube,
and
it'll be on
Instagram Live.
Yeah, it'll be on all of them, right? Wherever your audience is, the podcast needs to be there, right? So podcast is sort of, as a term, it's become an umbrella term to include, to basically say, if you have a regular multimedia show, right? And that allows you to build that, what I call the 3 A's, attention, awareness, and authority, for your business, right? That's not why everyone does a podcast, but if you're in the space as a business, it's because you're trying to develop attention, awareness, and authority for what it is that you do.
Got it. So thank you for explaining that. Now let's go back before, because we're how did you get into this? What were you doing before? What was like your 9-to-5 job, and how did you even started helping people with their coaching business? How did you get into that space?
That's it. Depends on how far you want to go back, but I started my entrepreneurial career at 13.
Really?
And I was that kid who, my dad, one day, one of his friends at work had brought him a copy of the Rich Dad Poor Dad book. My dad was like, "Oh, that's a cool book," and he gave it to me. Right? Had a little note and said, "Hey, I think your son might like this book." And I was like, I don't know, 11 or 12 at the time. And I got that book, and I spent every night for a week, and I read the book all the way through like 4 times, and sort of became a kid who was obsessed with this idea that you could control money. Right, that it didn't have to control you, and that came into sort of understanding like the cash flow quadrant and the idea that you have the E quadrant, which is employees and self-employed and business owners who build systems to create income and investors who put their money into to work for them, and learning all of those things as a kid, I was like, how do I get out of this E quadrant realm, which was all I'd ever known, because that's where my parents were. Nothing wrong with that. My parents were great employees and they had really good work. My dad did work for NASA. And I don't know if like the Voyager spaceship that's still out sending stuff back, the satellite, my dad did work on that, which is super cool. So like really high level stuff. And there's nothing wrong with the whole employee mindset or employee world. It's just not where I wanted to be. And so when I was 13, I convinced my dad to give me a loan for $50 and a ride to the big box grocery store. I told him I'd pay him back the money for the $50. And I was like, I don't know how to pay you back the ride to the grocery store. But anyways, he got me to the grocery store, and I spent $50 on all these big candies. It was like Nerd Ropes and, you know, those big 100 grand bars and the big Snickers bars. And I brought them to school in my, you know, my proverbial New York trench coat, look at my wares kind of thing. I was selling candy. I'm buying it wholesale at the big box store and selling it retail on campus for like $2 a bar or whatnot. And I managed over the course of 6 weeks or so to make about $1,500 in sales on that. And I remember the first time I bought $50 worth of candy and I sold it for $100, and I brought it back and I paid my dad back his $50. And then I had to go buy more inventory and I had $0. And I was like, what did I just do? Like I have no money. And then I had to learn what the difference was between profits and margins and inventory cost and that kind of stuff. So I learned those lessons young. And I remember I was asking my dad, like, what happened? And he had to actually look up some of the differences for me or with me so I could learn what that stuff meant. But I made it about 6 weeks before I had what I call my first government shutdown, because the school administration came to me and they were like, hey, you're not allowed to sell on campus without a business license, and you're 13, so you can't have a business license. Mm. So therefore you can't sell on campus. And I figure since it's a government institution, it was my first government shutdown.
Always the man. The man is always on our backs.
So that was how I got started in my entrepreneurial career. And over the course of years, I did several other things on campus where I tried to, you know, I sold water at the our Renaissance Fair and did some other things in high school. And then like I went to college and I paid my way through college as a self-employed business owner. I became the portrait photographer on campus and was also filming the weddings and stuff like that. And I paid my way through college as a portrait photographer and as a self-employed business owner. And then after college, I started I'd gotten into some MLM stuff in college, which I realized I didn't really like, but I learned a bunch from on the marketing side.
Yeah. I always tell people, go there and learn as much as you can, but it's not built for everybody, but there's so much education that
comes. Yeah, you can learn a lot there. Yeah. So the things I learned was about marketing and learning how to speak to people and speak persuasively.
Got it. And what were you selling? What was the product?
Mana V, I believe. It was a long time ago, but it was some sort of a fruit juice thing. Anyways, I took a lot of the skills that I had there and I realized that, hey, a lot of this marketing stuff, our local business community could make use of this, right? Because it was right at the beginning of the mobile marketing stuff, like the iPhone had just come out, and realizing that like they needed websites and they needed to be on Google Maps and they needed some of these other things and they needed to like actually use some direct response in their advertising, because, you know, the days of Yellow Pages were done. And so I started a local marketing agency and started working with local businesses and going to like the local networking groups and started learning to build websites and put together marketing stuff and build campaigns for local businesses, and did really well at the actual delivering of the services and was helping my clients really well, but did a really, really, really poor job of running a business. So things like,
was that because you just didn't have systems set in place, or you would just kind of like,
I didn't have systems, and I also didn't know how to charge for the value I was doing, right? Because I was still thinking like an employee, because again, that's what I grew up with. And so I was thinking, right, if, you know, if someone needs to have a mobile website built, and I've gotten really good at it, and it takes me 2 hours to build, and minimum wage is $8, then maybe I'll build this whole thing for them and charge them $16 for it, right? And then they would go and they would get it turned on and they would double their business over the next 6 months, right? Because they can show up everywhere. Yeah. Right? So I didn't actually know how to value charge services. And so it did a couple of things. One, it made it so I was constantly in that that starving mode. And I was also always having to, like, I was either working and not marketing because I didn't have enough money to do both. So if I was working, I had money to feed my kids. And if I wasn't, then I was putting all of our money into getting new clients, right? So it was like the whole feast or famine thing. So I was not very good as a business owner, right? And I was young and I didn't really know what I was doing. But I was really good at what I was doing, if that makes sense. So I was making a good impact with the people I was working with. And I realized at some point that I needed to stop the whole feast, famine, starving thing. And so it was, 2012, end of the year. I think it was December 28th. I remember it pretty clearly. My business partner and I decided we were going to shut down the business. And we would go and take our skills as marketing professionals and bring them to larger companies as an employee. Right. And I wanted to get into the director of marketing position was what I was looking for, right, from a title standpoint, because I knew I would be like in charge of marketing for a large company. And I was like, I specifically wanted to be at a place where I had at least a $20,000 a month marketing budget. And I wanted to have a charge of a marketing team. And I wanted to be able to do all of the marketing stuff to really hone my skills there and not have to worry about putting food on the table because a paycheck would be coming in. So I actually went the other direction. Most people are like in the corporate world and trying to go to create a business. I had a business, was failing at it, decided in order to solve some of my problems, I needed to get back into the corporate world, or into the corporate world for the first time in my case.
You and I are very similar in that sense. I kind of had that same kind of trajectory. I was an entrepreneur from like all of my 20s. And then in my 30s, I kind of went into the employment realm and finally learned systems from there, and then decided to do it on my own again.
Yeah. So it took me 4 weeks, and I went, I managed to beat out 258 other applicants for a position that I had none of the stated qualifications for. And I managed to get them to pay me for the 4 weeks that I spent looking for the job and applying for it. And I managed to get work from home position. So I was still acting like a employee at home. And then I used part of my salary to hire hire VAs. So I got like 10 times more work done than any of their other employees. Because I didn't need all the money they were paying me. So I was...
Yeah, because you were already living off of a very, very low amount of money before.
So I crushed it for them over the next 15 months and had some really, really cool opportunities. Like the CEO of the company was one of the original Microsoft guys. And he made, you know, a metric ass ton of money. And he was on the board of 12 different companies. And every week I got to sit under him and learn how he was running a business and what he cared about and why. Right. And the president of the company that I direct reported to, I got to sit with him, you know, two or three times a week and look at all the numbers and what mattered and why, and how important things like, you know, having payroll in the bank for 6 months was, so that, you know, cause he's like, the most important thing to him, was making sure that their staff was taken care of, was paid and stuff like that. So I learned a lot from them and from that position. And over the course of my tenure there, I was in charge of a $25,000 a month marketing budget, and we 10x'd their lead flow while I was there, which for a company that size made a sizable impact on their revenue. And so it was really, really cool. And I, at the end of the 15 months, I gave them a 3 month notice essentially and said, hey, I've got what I wanted to get from this position. So I helped them hire and train and look for my replacement, and stepped down and went back into starting my consulting business again. And
Got it. So when you went back to the consulting business, what was your frame of mind? Were you a little bit way more prepared, way more knowledge at this point?
I was. I had a lot better preparation, and I learned how to do things like having buy-in on both sides of the aisle, right? So like one of the things I used to do before was I always thought about how what I was bringing to the deal, not what the other person was bringing to the deal. And realized, like, you know, watching these guys negotiate multi-million dollar contracts, they always would talk about, hey, here's what we're bringing to the table and what are you bringing to the table? So it's like, what are your gives and your asks, right? Because you can't just have one. So learning how to set up deals where both of us had vested interest. So my first deal actually was a percentage of profits deal that I did with someone, and I had been working with them for several years. And just the percentage of profits that I had with them was bigger than my my paycheck that I was making before that was six figures. So it was pretty cool.
Wow.
And worked with them for several years. I still had a couple of problems with pricing because I hadn't fixed all my problems yet. I still don't think I have, but I remember one of my big mistakes after then was I had someone hired me for a new space I wanted to get in, which was webinars. I was doing really good work with one of my clients, my first client, doing some webinars. And I was like, hey, I think I could expand this line. And my next client I brought in, they were like, yeah, I'll hire you. And they paid me $500 because that's what I asked them to pay me. And then I wrote their webinar for them and helped them deliver it and get in front of their audience and do all the things. We did two live webinars. And in 6 weeks, I made him $250,000 in sales.
And you only took
$500. So I still managed to make some mistakes. but
that sucks.
It does. But it also taught me some valuable lessons, right? And it also reminded me, like, hey, I actually know how to do this stuff, and I have the value to back it up, and I have the stories to back it up. And over the course of the next couple of years, I have built my business to the point where it is now. And it was it's almost 4 years ago now. We decided I could move our business virtual almost entirely instead of meeting people in person to do all the work that we were doing, and started traveling. And we've been, like I said, this is my RV here in my little miniature studio. If I zoomed out on the camera, you could actually see the closet and the bed behind me and whatnot in my little miniature studio that I have back here. And we've been traveling the country for 4 years and growing our business. I have, three staff members, and then myself. So there's four of us now that run the agency, and you know, we do all that stuff virtually. So anyways, that brings you full circle from 13 to where we are now.
Wow. So I really want to just jump into the traveling thing. What was the precipice? What pushed that to actually be the reason why you guys decided to go on the road? Was it just because you wanted to travel, or what was the deal?
So a couple of things. It actually, some of it ties back into my story as a kid. And I mentioned my dad had some cool work that he did. And you know, it was like probably three or four times a year, he would take time off of work and we would go adventure.
Okay.
And go for a couple of weeks. You know, we'd go out to Lake Mead or Lake Mojave or up into the mountains. We were out in the Southwest area. And so we always did cool stuff. We'd go up to Yosemite or we'd go up to Trinity Mountain. And those memories from my childhood were always my favorite. Right. And I wished for myself that we could have more of that. And I remember when I became a dad myself, I had a couple of things that I really wanted. One is I wanted to give my kids as much of me as I wanted to have from my dad, but couldn't because he worked full time. Right. So that was one of those things. And the other one is I wanted to have those adventures, right? I wanted to cram as much adventure into my life as I could, because I almost feel like we owe it to our creator to experience this creation he made for us.
Yeah.
You know, it's something my wife and I have been talking about for like 4 or 5 years. And it's kind of a fun story. We had, my wife had a little notebook of goals, from when we'd first gotten married. Mm-hmm. And when we were packing everything up and putting it into the RV, that was in May of 2017. And I found her little notebook and I opened up to the last page and it had said goals. And it said May 2012, where do I want to be in 5 years? And one of the bullet points was I want to be moving into an RV and traveling with my family.
Oh, wow.
And it was like almost 5 years to the day we were moving into an RV and traveling around the country, which is super cool. That's, you know, awesome. So side note for write down goals, eventually you can make them happen.
That's awesome, because I was going to ask you, how did you convince your wife to jump in the RV and do that?
But yeah, so it was something we'd both wanted to do. And the catalyst actually was we were renting a house at the time, and we were getting ready to re-sign the lease, and we had just talked to the landlord or the property management, and they were like, yeah, I'll bring over the lease next week. We can re-sign it and re-up for the next year. And he calls me. He's like, so about that lease that I was going to bring over, I can't bring it over because the owner of the property wants to sell. So Whoa. you won't be able to renew. And we had like 45 days or something like that to vacate the property. And he was like, I've got several other properties. We can help find you another place. And it's like, we just had a baby and all this stuff. And I was like, oh, well, that's always fun. And so my wife and I, we were chatting about it. And I was like, we had just hit a point where we knew we like without the lease was the only thing holding us to that location.
Got it. And if that was gone, then there was no
real
reason.
If that was gone. Yeah. Then I was like, then we don't, I don't have a job in this particular spot. I'd been working on moving my clients to virtual. And like my family lived around there, which of course traveling would mean that we'd have to disconnect from them. Like we couldn't go over to dinner every week because we're traveling and whatnot. But I was like, we could work that out and it would be worthwhile for the adventure and those kind of things. I was like, so we don't have anything holding us here. So my wife and I chatted about it and we're like, let's do it. So, we packed everything into our car the next day and went and drove 1800 miles around the country to look at three different RVs. And we didn't actually have the cash in the bank when we got in the car and drove away to buy the RV. So my wife drove while I sat on the side and I started calling clients and getting projects. And before we got to the RV, I had cash in the bank to buy the RV.
That's awesome. That's so awesome.
Yeah. So we looked at one that was terrible. The second one we ended up buying in Texas and we drove it home. And that's a whole fun story in and of itself. And then the third one, my business partner actually looked at and he ended up buying that one. So we looked at three RVs and bought two. Wow. And we both started traveling and we got back. I had 14 days and we renovated the RV and my wife took apart our house and sold and donated everything we didn't need. And we moved it all into the RV. And with 24 hours left to spare, we moved our family to an RV and drove off. And here we are 4 years later.
Wow. So that's an incredible story. I wanted to jump in the episode really quickly to tell you about today's sponsor. Today's sponsor is True Digital Designs. That's TRU Digital Designs. Now, I'm going to be honest. When I was looking for a place to build my website, I was lost in the sauce. I didn't know which way to go. Should I go WordPress? Should I go this? I was just confused. And I reached out to a good friend of mine, Andrew John. He's the founder of True Digital Designs. And he was able to make us a clean, beautiful, mobile-first website. And, you know, the great part about Andrew and his company is that he understands that early-stage entrepreneurs have to fund everything themselves. So he offers even payment plans to help people get their website started. And you don't have to break your bank to get that thing going, especially when you're just starting to fund your side hustle. So he understands that. He works with entrepreneurs and he gives you exactly what you're looking for your website. And for all the H for Hustle listeners, he's giving you a promo code. It's Hustle15. Go to websites TRUDigitalDesigns.com. Type in the code Hustle15 and you get 15% off the prices that he has there. So let's get back into the episode. You know, 2020, a lot of people were forced into this virtual life, but it seems like you kind of were living that years before. How were you able to manage all of that with kids, with wife, with work? How are you able to kind of do everything and manage all of that in a very small space? Because a lot of people kind of went into that in the past year. How were you able to manage that from the beginning?
So there's a lot of things that sort of go into that question, right? There's a lot to unpack there. So everything from like time management to like, how do you work in a small space? To how do you have internet connection and things like that? So like the internet stuff has been crazy, right? It's only getting better. But like when we first started, it was like one of those, I actually probably have one sitting here, those little mobile hotspots. I don't know what I did with them.
You could get from like Verizon or Sprint.
Yeah, from Verizon. Okay. I have the battery for one sitting here. But anyways, yeah, the little hotspots that you put your SIM card in. And I had one of those. And eventually I upgraded it to, I've got a commercial router now that goes for tour buses. And it's got two modems in it. And each modem has fail-safe SIM cards. So I can put four SIM cards in it and it'll automatically. So I can have AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile. I pay more for cell service than most people would ever ever drink because it makes my life possible, right?
Yeah.
So I've got a $1,000 commercial router, and I've got a $500 cell phone signal booster with an antenna that I can put up when I need it, an omnidirectional and a directional antenna. So like I'm figuring out how to take care of the internet. Super excited for Elon Musk's SpaceX satellite internet stuff to come out because I know the beta stuff is happening.
And that would just take you to another level.
take it to another level, right? So you figure that stuff out. And then you figure out things like, well, I have to do meetings and things. So you learn how to build a miniature studio in my office here. So you can actually see if I move this camera around, you can see I've got a hanging backdrop.
Yeah.
And I've got a light set up here, and I've got a microphone hanging from the ceiling, right? So I learned how to build a little miniature studio. So when I got on the phone with my clients or potential clients, I could have a professional appearance and show up good and do those kind of things. And then the rest of it is learning how to manage family in a small space.
Yeah, right? So that's the next thing I was going to say. Like, how are you doing meetings with kids doing schoolwork? Like, it's got to be unbelievable.
Our kids are homeschooling, and also they're all young, right? So they're loud and annoying, but they're also amazing. And part of that is learning how to pick your clients, right? And my clients all know up front that I travel full time and I'm a father of four kids. And there's things that go along with that. Sometimes we're going to get on the phone and you're going to get, you know, my toddler is going to run in butt naked and want to say hi, which happened literally today, right? I was on the phone with one of my clients and my toddler knows them. We've actually been to their house because whenever we get into areas where our clients live, we always like to go to dinner and meet them and that kind of stuff. So like she actually knows the lady I was on the phone with. And she runs in, she's not wearing anything, she's potty training, and she's like, hi, I want to talk to you and say hi. So anyways, it's part of the life. And I know like if people have been going through that this year and they learn that like, you know, people are actually really forgiving mm-hmm. about family and life because they have all the same things happening in their life.
Yep.
Right. And what I've found is that everyone that I get on the phone with or get on the line with, when they realize that like, hey, and I tell them right up front, I was like, I run my business and I do everything I do for these kids, right? So they're a huge part of my life. You know, I do my best to keep them, you know, out of our professional meetings and whatnot, but every once in a while, something's going to happen. They're going to show up and you're going to see a naked toddler butt. and it's going to happen. And you know what, that I think it actually makes for stronger relationships with my clients and other things, because they know who I am and what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. But from like an actual management standpoint, I've got two doors between me and the front side of the RV, you know, because the way it's set up is like there's the front room and then there's the bathroom and then there's our back bedroom.
Yeah.
So like the back bedroom door and then the door between the front and the bathroom both close, and we'll close them both up. And I'll put up a little thing that says, hey, I'm on the phone or I'm recording or whatnot. And so the kids know pretty well to be quiet or to stay out. But you know, you can't do much with an 18-month-old who thinks she runs the world. but so there's that. And if I ever need it to be really quiet, we're generally always in cool places. So it's like, hey, can you, you know, I'll ask my wife, can you take the kids to the park for an hour? They're never sad about stuff like that. So, you know, occasionally it's a little tough. Like if it's raining or snowing outside and you're all stuck inside and then, you know, the kids are going stir crazy, then, you know, stuff happens. But that's part of the, you know, the whole give and take of living a mobile lifestyle like we do.
So have you guys went around the full United States already, or you've been taking?
We haven't yet. We were almost, so the pandemic ruined our last year's travels. We spent 9 months stuck in Florida. And it's funny, we pulled into Florida where we were going to stay 3 hours before they shut the state down.
Wow.
And everything. And they canceled all of our reservations all the way down the East Coast and up the East Coast. We got all of our money back for it, but we ended up just being stuck in Florida for most of the year. We were only just recently able to move right before Christmas. And we're up in South Carolina right now. But our plan last year was to go all the way up to Maine and back down. And we're going to try to do that this year. And then that'll mean we'll have all of the East Coast, because we've done the West Coast, we've done all the Midwest, we've done the entire South, and now we've done a little bit of the Southeast. So anyways, if we can hit the East Coast and then a couple of the Northern states, we'll have seen the whole country, which we were supposed to do, get the East Coast last year. But, you know, pandemic ruined everyone else's plans too, so I'm not too upset about it.
Yeah, it's everybody got shelved a little bit, so it's not that big of a deal. If you're in Jersey, you know, shoot me an email.
Will do.
All right. So, you know, a lot of the audience, this podcast, they kind of are stuck between, you know, they're dying a slow death. They're in a cubicle. They want to make a transition. They probably have admired the life that you have or created for yourself. What advice would you give to that person who's stuck in that cubicle and they want to make a decision to, you know, have a more virtual life or a more remote life like you do? What advice would you give that person?
So two things pop into my head. The first one is learn how to build parachutes on the way down. And what I mean by that is entrepreneurs take risks. They're the kind of people who jump off of the cliff and then learn how to build a parachute on the way down, right? And, you know, it's a risk to move into an RV, and it's a risk to shut down your business and take a job. And then it's another risk to take your six-figure job and quit to start your business back up again. but, you realize that, like, it's the taking the risks and let me rephrase that. Not just taking the risk, but taking the risk with in a well-managed way, right? That you know what you're going to do and how you're going to do it, and you know, you're prepared for whatever the worst things are, right? And you realize that, like, for the most part, the worst that can happen isn't that bad, right? And you know how to come back from it, right? And you could figure it out. And so the thing that stops most people is they think about the worst that can happen, and they let that stop them instead of looking at, hey, what's the worst that could happen? And then what would I do to come back from there? Right.
Got it.
That's part of that parachute building mentality. We realize, like, hey, if I got shoved off of a cliff, what would I do? I'd learn to build a parachute on the way down. Right. And that's the first one, is just learn how to both look at the risk and then learn how to manage that in your head. Cause most of the risk is here. Cause very, very rarely does the worst that could happen happen. Right. Most of the time you're going to be somewhere in the middle, and in the middle is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
So you take the risk and you move on, you go forward with that. So that's the first one, is don't let your fears or your thought of the risks stop you. And the second one is, how do you become prepared to take those risks? And the thing that I would recommend is take where you're at and look at how you can stack your skills, because skill stacking is what lets you do things that other people can't do. And so here's what I mean by that. When you look at the things that you are, if you want to be really, really good at something where you can actually trade your services for money, mm-hmm. right? The way that you end up in those places is becoming world-class in that area, right? And if you look at, like, how do you become world-class in one area, that's really, really difficult to do, right? So if you wanted to become a world-class athlete or a world-class actor or something like that, you have some tough competition. And it's, you know, to get into the top, you know, 1% of a group is a lifetime's worth of effort.
Yeah.
But if you want to hack that, the way that you hack that is what I call skill stacking. And skill stacking is where you say, hey, I want to get really, really good at this thing, right? And so I'll give you an example in my life. One of the things I'm really, really good at is technology and figuring out how to marry technology with other things and helping explain technology to other people. And if you can get into the top 10% of understanding of a thing, that's not so hard, right? Because very few people are willing to put in the time and effort to get into the top 10% of anything. So you can do that fairly readily. And what's interesting is, if you take that, right, I got really good at technology. And the other thing I got really good at, and this was from my career in college and some other things that I was doing, I got really good at doing persuasive teaching.
Got it.
Right. And where those two intersect, you have a smaller thing. If you're in the top 10% over here and the top 10% over here, where those two intersect, suddenly you're in the top 5, top 4, 3%.
Got it.
And if you do that again, right, and you take a third skill, right, and for me, right, if you take that persuasive teaching and I take the technology, and the last one for me is learning how to do systems, right, how to build systems and do the marketing and that kind of stuff that goes into it, and put all those together, now I have a business in that area where what we do for our clients, we're some of the best at in the world in that little segment.
Got it. So you've literally taken three skills, stacked them in, and kind of created your own niche that's kind of overlay right in the middle.
Yeah. And when you want someone to, if you want to get to a point where you're like, hey, we're not just like the best or, you know, a great option, we're like the best option in this area, right? You can do that by stacking those skills together. Right. So like our Push Button podcast business has a lot of those things put together for us. right? You know, a lot of it is built on some really cool system stuff they learned how to build. We've taken a lot of advantage of really cool technologies to allow us to build those systems. And the persuasive teaching element is our entire marketing element and the background for like how we're teaching our clients how to do what we're doing. And putting those together, and we end up in a really nice place, right? Where we're like, hey, we're the best of the world here. And right, and my heroic brand is the same way, right? It's taking three different skill areas and putting them together in a unique way. And it's that skill stacking thing, right? You can take stuff that you're learning in your job or the skills that you have there and figure out how do those help you in your business. And then the last thing is not really a piece of advice. It's just a rule that if you want to get into business, you have to have something to sell. And my recommendation for that is just in your head, the way that you come up with that is you have to find a group of people that have a problem. And if that group of people has a problem, and they have money that they're willing to spend to solve that problem, all you have to do is come up with a unique solution that helps solve that problem for them, and then put the messenger together to help put those two together, right? Group of people with money and a problem and the solution that you've created, and you put those together with your marketing and your messaging, right? And that the solution that you come up with, that's where your skill stacking comes together. So if you can stack those skills and come up with a unique solution to help a group of people that have a problem, you have your business.
Wow, that is one of the best answers I've ever heard on this show, given, and that's so specific. How would you deal with the perceived failure that you had within your business, right? You started this marketing agency, this consulting agency. It wasn't going well. You didn't know how to price. You just didn't have all the right things. You shut it down and then went and got a job. How did you deal with that? Because a lot of people have that, like they might have went from corporate to start their own thing, it didn't work out, and they have to go back to corporate again. How did you deal with that transition of starting over and going into another thing?
So I have a mentality. I don't know exactly where I got this from, but it's something that I say all the time to myself and my kids and my staff. And it's that mistakes are stepping stones to greatness. Right. And it's this idea that we have that failure is not a destination. Right. And a lot of times we, for whatever reason, think that failure is a destination. We're like, I have failed. Right. And I am therefore a failure. And it's difficult for people to wrap their mind around that, to have something that just doesn't work. But when you realize, and you know, you've probably heard the classic story of Thomas Edison and the light bulb, and how many light bulbs did he make before he got one that worked, right? Some like 1,000 light bulbs that didn't work, right? And those can either, you know, they're all failures, right? But what are those failures? Every failure is another stepping stone to greatness, right? And so that's where, that's how I've always just managed it in my own head. Is like, okay, this is I failed at this thing. What can I learn from that thing, and how does it provide the next step on my journey, right? And you know, where can I take that forward? And then, you know, for me, it's always, you know, that's how I look at my failures. Is like they're the stepping stones on my journey to where I'm going.
Got it. So you just look at it as just another step. What's the lesson you can find in it? What you can learn from the failure? Yeah. And what was the big
I say just for people's like understanding that just because it comes out easily when I say it on the podcast, it doesn't mean it's easy to do.
Yeah.
And when you have a failure, you still have all the emotions, and you have all the, like, you know, that it's tough and it hurts and it hurts your pride. And sometimes you have to sit down and be like, hey, honey, I royally effed up, and we're going to have to fix this and figure out how to get the next thing. You have to do the hard work that goes with struggling through failure. But that's part of the process. Right. And it's what makes you stronger and makes you a good business owner going forward.
Got it. And, you know, there was a through line that you were saying that you kind of had trouble figuring out pricing. What was the thing that was blocking you from your pricing? Like, what lesson did you learn to be able to price better?
So I have something that I call my 310 rule now.
310 rule. What is that?
310 rule. And it has to do with learning how to sell with value. Okay. Instead of learning how to sell on time or other
functions,
things
or
functions. And it's very difficult to put into numbers unless you are in a space that offers a very particular ROI. So sometimes you have to do some thinking on this stuff. Like, right, if you're in the relationship space, for instance, there's not like a, hey, if you get a good relationship, you make $10,000, right? Unlike marketing, where it's like, hey, if you do run these ads and you make these sales, you make this much money. Really easy to do ROI there. But very few businesses have that kind of ROI. So the way I think about this 3-10 rule is that whatever your price is, I want the real and perceived ROI to be at a minimum 3 times whatever the asking price is, right? Okay. So if my asking price is $100, I want the ROI to you to be 300, right? And what now that this is where it comes into, like, maybe it's not a direct monetary ROI. Maybe it is time saved. Maybe it is maybe it is money. Maybe it's it's peace, or whatever the thing is that you're offering. You have to take into account the various ways that what you're offering to someone, your products or services, how does it impact their life, right? And if you're selling a surfboard and the surfboard is going to get them out on the ocean, is going to improve their health and add 10 years to their life and blah, 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 whatever the things are, you have to take all that stuff into account and think, okay, the surfboard costs $1,000. Are they going to get, at a minimum, if they use it, are they going to get at least $3,000 worth of value out of it? Right? So that's the three rule. So the three rule is like, that's where I'll put my pricing. Right. Is like, what's the minimum ROI that I can expect someone to get if they just try a little bit with this product or with this service? And so that's where we'll price things, is like whatever that number is. And we'll take into account, like, what is the time that they're saving, or, what kind of emotional benefits are we doing? What kind of other things is it going to, help them save money on taxes because they don't have to hire an employee because they're hiring us. Right. Which are things that people don't always think about. If they're hiring you for a service, as a 1099 employee, they don't have to pay the payroll tax.
Yeah.
Right. That they would have to pay on an employee that they had in house. So that's a huge savings right there. So you have to take in all those things into account, that just in your head. And I want whatever number I come up with, my pricing has to at least be a third of that.
Got it.
So the you're minimum trying to ROI see is really easy.
How much value you can bring versus, so mm-hmm. you're trying to see what your value is, what the value is to the customer. What are they going to get back? It might be monetary, it might be time, might be ease of life, might be taxes. And then that's where you kind of figure out where your pricing should lie.
You have to look at the value that I'm bringing to them, right? So you learn mm-hmm. how to sell on value. And then it's when you go to that, one third of that, it makes it really easy, like, no duh, because when they start thinking about all of it too, and it also helps inform your marketing and other things, you can start talking about where the value lies for them. And then the 10 part of that, the 3-10, is I want there to be the potential for 10 times the value the service or in the product, stuff like that, right? So if we go back to that surfboard thing, surfboards can, if you were to rent a surfboard for the afternoon, it costs you $100. Right now, so and you're gonna do it there. And if the surfboard's gonna last 10 years, and you just did the rental fees for the surfboard, and they went out every day for a week, after a year, they've way more than 10x their return on their investment, right? And I know, like, we did that with kayaks at one point when we were first traveling. We were renting kayaks whenever we went, and finally, I was like, it doesn't make sense to keep renting kayaks because we keep using them, and they're $25 for an hour to rent one, and we have to rent 3 of them for our family, and they only cost $1,000. So the return on investment for us is really high. So I like to think about that as, like, what's the minimum ROI? Like, hey, if we only use the kayaks every, once every 6 months, are we still going to make an ROI on it? We will, right? Over the course of our traveling, we're going to make that. And then the potential is that, if we spend all summer someplace and we use the kayaks every day, when we're staying on the ocean, that 10 or 15 or 20x ROI is there, right? And so I like people to think to themselves when you're pricing things, okay, is the minimum ROI, the 3X rule, is it there? Because that's what's going to make it a no-duh sell for your clients. And the 10X is what's going to make it really easy in their head to justify it. Because they're like, hey, I could get so much more value than even what they're telling me about. Right? That's my 3-10 rule for pricing.
That's awesome. That is an awesome way to think about pricing. I never thought about it like that. That's definitely a really, really good way of looking at it. I'm actually going to re-listen. When I re-listen to this, I'm definitely going to cut that out. I really want to dissect that a little bit more, because that's actually really, really smart, especially when it comes to a service that sometimes you can't really put. It's not like tangible, right? It's not like you do X and get X. It's like you have to try to figure out where your value is for both sides of it. And that's actually a really, really good point. So, What is the one thing that being an entrepreneur, like, what's the thing that entrepreneur has, how has it been good? How has entrepreneur impact your life in a good way and a bad way? What would you say that the impact is for both sides? Because most people talk about just the good parts of being free and stuff, but there's also a bad side to being free as well.
So let me start with the good parts, because that's pretty standard type stuff. So the good part of that is, like you mentioned, like the freedom and the being in charge of my own schedule. And that, you know, I'm a really, really bad employee, like just the worst. And because I want to do my own things my own way. And I don't like inefficiencies. And when you're working in a corporate job, you have to deal with the inefficiencies the way that mm-hmm. they are.
You and I are the same.
And you don't have the ability to be like, you need to fix all this because it's effing up my day. So like the freedom to be able to be like, hey, I've got this problem in our business, and be able to come up with solutions and fix it and change those things and have the freedom to, so like one of my biggest wins in my business over the last 5 years has been learning how to do what I call, creative limitations on the time I spend in the business. Right. So when I first started as an entrepreneur, I was really bad at,
shutting it
giving
down.
Giving myself limitations on the amount of time I was spending. So I would spend 18 hours a day, which does not help you grow your business, by the way. If you're spending 18 hours a day in your business, you're just spinning your wheels, I promise you. I started doing things like, what happens if I say restrict myself to 8-hour days? And, you know, what happens if I restrict myself to 4 days a week? And then what happens if I restrict myself to 6-hour days? And what happens if I restrict myself to 4-hour days? And now my business, because of that, it's I work on average about 4 hours a day, 4 days a week. And my business is growing, right? Because of having, like, I have the freedom to have those kind of creative restrictions in my business that helps grow it.
And that was because you decided to take yourself out of it.
Mm-hmm. Build systems and do things like that. Because when you start giving yourself restrictions, like, hey, I'm not going to work 8 hours a day, I'm going to work 6 hours a day.
You get more efficient with the 6 hours.
Yeah. How do I make that happen? And then you go, okay, well, now instead of working 4-5 days a week, I'm going to work 4 days a week and still keep the 6-hour a day thing. What needs to change in order for us to get the same results or better results? Right. And so if you learn to ask yourself better questions, you get better answers. And so those were some of the better questions I started asking myself. And it forces you to get the right stuff done and build the right systems. So anyways, that's the first part of that. And then the other part, the flip side of that, right? That's the, you know, good stuff. You get the freedom, you get to sort of build your life the way that you want it. Yeah. Design your life, so to speak. The flip side of that is that you're in charge.
And just like that, another illustrious episode is in the can. Now, one thing that I liked that Richard said was, you have to take that leap and get comfortable building the plane while you're falling out of the sky. Like, and that was something that stuck with me after this interview. And it's one of those things that is so true, but it's a mindset you almost have to have and you have to get ready for. So that's one of the bigger takeaways for me. Let me know what you guys take away from this episode. I love this episode so much. He dropped so much value and so much information. Please go check out his company's links are down in the description. I would love to know what you guys took away from this episode. Hit me up, H for Hustle Podcast on Instagram. Hit me up, I am Jerome Fenton. Hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. I would love your feedback on this episode. That's it, guys. All I have for this week. I'm going to close out with a quote from the late great Nipsey Hussle. The quote goes, "This game will test you. Never fold. Stay 10 toes down, because it's not on you, it's in you. And what's in you, they can't take away." That's it, guys. Peace. Boom. Boom.